Case number 15-7098, Matthew Corrigan, appellant versus District of Columbia et al. Ms. Rademacher for the appellant, Mr. Schifferle for the appellees.
Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Tillman Breckenridge of the William & Mary Law School, and I'm just here to introduce Elizabeth M. Rademacher, who will argue on behalf of Mr. Corrigan.
Thank you. Counsel?
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. On February 3rd, 2010, D.C. police violated Matthew Corrigan's Fourth Amendment rights when they searched his home without a warrant, without consent, and after he had been restrained outside his home. We ask this court to reverse the summary judgment from the district court below for all defendants for the following reasons. First, the warrantless entry occurred without consent and without indicia of danger to others. Second, no exception to the Fourth Amendment justifies the search of Mr. Corrigan's home, nor may the district collaterally attack its unconstitutionality after its failed prosecution of Mr. Corrigan. Third, the right against warrantless entry in such a situation is clearly established. And fourth, the district has an unconstitutional custom or practice in place which caused Mr. Corrigan's rights to be violated. First, there were no indicia of danger to others. Police need indicia of danger to themselves or the community to enter a home without a warrant.
So let's see. The district court, at the end of its opinion, made a series of findings.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the district court talks about sort of the two interests that need to be balanced here in terms of qualified immunity, and concludes that, as I understand her position, that there were exigent circumstances.
Yes, Your Honor, that is what the district court concluded. However, we argue that there were no exigent circumstances that justified this entry.
So is your position that the police, having taken all of these precautionary measures, and Mr. Corrigan having been taken out of the house, the only reasonable action consistent with the Fourth Amendment would have been to have obtained a search warrant for his house, for his apartment?
The police could have done several things, Your Honor, including get a search warrant. They also could have not searched Mr. Corrigan's home at all. Our position is that no exigent circumstances justified going inside without a warrant, though. They had 6 hours to do so to obtain a warrant, and they did not. And moreover, we would argue that there were no indicia of danger that justified such a warrantless entry.
So the indicia, as I understand it, on which the officers say they were relying in going in, was they had been called to the home of someone who was suicidal. At least that was their reasonable understanding based on the information that they received. And it was someone who had military explosives expertise. He had a military bag in his apartment that his girlfriend said, he said, contained military items. She should not touch it, raising perhaps a reasonable inference that there was something volatile or dangerous in it, perhaps. When they arrived on the scene, there was a smell of gas. They tried to get Mr. Corrigan to come to the door. He didn't. He delayed. They don't know why at that time, and they're just acting on the information that they have. And Mr. Corrigan, as they understand it, is generally pretty miserable. He has PTSD. He is not being cooperative. He has sent them to a false address after they speak to him on the phone. So is it your position that no reasonable officer, when confronted with those circumstances, would think that there's probable cause for concern that there might be some explosive causing danger to the community?
Your Honor, we dispute several of those facts or inferences that are posited by the district for why the officers would have had a reasonable suspicion.
Okay, so let me just take two questions.
Sure.
Before you dispute the factual bases that I listed, if those are in fact undisputed facts of record, do you think on the basis of those facts there is nonetheless not reasonable cause, probable cause to believe that there is a risk?
Your Honor, we would say no. We think that Mr. Corrigan's background as a veteran and the fact that he has PTSD caused the officers to speculate about what would be happening inside his apartment, but that these speculations or these inferences that they made were unreasonable because they automatically jumped to the conclusion that he had something dangerous in his home simply because he's served in the military and because he has a bag of military items.
Okay, so that's your purely legal. And then you said you dispute some of the facts. So if you could tell us what you think are the material factual disputes and just catalog those, that would be helpful.
Yes, Your Honor. First, there's a dispute about whether there was actually a smell of gas at all that night. For instance, on JA-53, the police internal report says that there was a noted strong odor of gas. However, none of the police that are defendants to this action smelled gas on the night in question. For instance, on JA-193, in Sergeant Pope's deposition, he says that he didn't smell any gas. And at JA-377, Officer Leone also says he didn't smell anything.
Undisputed. They had the gas company turn off the gas in the area. Is that correct?
They did call the gas company, Your Honor, to ask them to turn off gas. However, it is within the record. There are some inconsistencies about whether anyone actually did smell gas that night.
What's your other disputed fact?
Our other disputes of fact, Your Honor, include the fact that Mr. Corrigan said that he wouldn't hurt anyone else, according to the district. Now, on JA-557, Mr. Corrigan says in his deposition that he did not say he wouldn't hurt anyone else. He says that first he was asked if he would hurt himself and then if he would hurt others, and he answered no to both questions. However, the district says that Mr. Corrigan said affirmatively that he wouldn't hurt anyone else. So we would say that there is a genuine dispute of that fact in the record. Your Honor, there is a dispute about whether or not the police would have gone inside at all that night if they had smelled gas, if there were any gas. For instance, on JA-619, Lieutenant Glover says that they needed to go inside because there was a risk of a natural gas leak. But then on JA-293, Sergeant Pope is talking in his deposition about how they would have backed off if there was something dangerous or an explosive that could have been a risk to the ERT team.
What about the district court's finding that they didn't know where the girlfriend was, and she and the plaintiff had a somewhat testy relationship?
Your Honor, the fact that Mr. Corrigan's ex-girlfriend had been contacted, the police could have asked her where she was, but they did not. And a reasonable jury could find that there was no reason to believe that she was inside the home. Moreover, just because...
I guess my question is, if she's being held by him, she's not going to be able to signal to them where she is. I mean, maybe they didn't investigate far enough, but I'm just trying to understand, because when the district court makes the findings it makes, it doesn't rely on these disputed facts that you're talking about in terms of concluding that there were exigent circumstances justifying the entry.
Your Honor, when the police spoke to Mr. Corrigan's ex-girlfriend, they didn't ask her where she was at all, as far as the record indicates. Now, the fact that they automatically assumed that she was inside and that Mr. Corrigan had hostages, we are saying is unreasonable because it was speculative. They also asked Mr. Corrigan's landlord if he had, you know, any overnight guests or if he lived alone. The fact that Mr. Corrigan has ever had an overnight guest in his life does not indicate that he had overnight guests that night. And moreover, no one saw an overnight guest that night. So we're saying that this is at best speculative.
Do you think that officers have to be able to establish both probable cause and exigent circumstances?
Your Honor, in order to go inside for an exigent circumstance, this court has held in United States v. Dawkins that they must have exigent circumstances and probable cause to go inside for the purpose of the exigent circumstances doctrine.
And that's not probable cause that a crime has been committed or that they'll find evidence of a crime, but probable cause to believe that there is such an exigency? Is that how you understand it?
That's my understanding, Your Honor. In the Evans case, Your Honor, did you have a question?
Who has the burden to show exigent circumstances? I think there's a line, at least in your brief, characterizing it as an affirmative defense. And I wasn't sure whether you cited a case for that.
Your Honor, I believe what we were referring to in the brief is that at the district court level, at the D.C. Superior Court level, that there was an affirmative duty on behalf of the district to show that to not suppress the evidence that there was some exigent circumstance that justified their entry. I believe that's what we're referring to.
Whose burden is it here in a civil case?
In a civil case, Your Honor, I believe that the plaintiff has to show that there was no probable cause.
The plaintiff has to show a lack of exigent circumstances?
I'm not sure, Your Honor.
So the plaintiff shows warrantless entry without justification under the Fourth Amendment, and as part of that, we're assuming that the plaintiff has to show there was no exigent circumstance giving a justification.
Yes, Your Honor. Now, under the Evans case from the D.C. Court of Appeals, we feel that it is related to this case and, you know, very helpful for understanding the issues here. In that case, the court said that police must have an objectively reasonable belief that they need to go inside someone's home. They can't operate on a we have no way of knowing standard or a bare possibility standard. Instead, they need an objective reasonable belief. And what we're arguing here, Your Honor, is that there was no objective reasonable belief. Moreover, Mincy tells us that, you know, an emergency can justify such a search, but it can only happen if you can articulate specific and articulable facts, that there's a reasonable belief that there's an exigency that exists. In this situation, there was no such belief.
Would you like to save the rest of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. Carl Schifferle for the District of Columbia Appellees. The District Court correctly determined that the search was reasonable under the alarming and dangerous circumstances that officers confronted that night. At the very least,
what about the fact that the officers had taken all of these precautionary steps, gotten the gas company to turn off the gas, they'd evacuated the building, they'd taken the plaintiff into custody. So at that point, why wasn't a warrant required if they wanted to go into his apartment, especially when he told them he did not consent and he closed and if they said lock the door?
Because the exigency existed still at the time that Mr. Corrigan left his apartment.
What was it?
Well, there was the reason that was given for the search, and the first of all, that there was the concern about persons inside who might need assistance.
They evacuated the building.
They evacuated the people upstairs in the separate unit, but as far as the basement apartment, there was a concern that there might be somebody inside.
Mr. Schifferle, they never even asked the girlfriend where she was, and they said, oh, there was no way to confirm her location. They would think the first way one would try to confirm a location if one is concerned about a person in danger is to ask that person.
Yeah, well, the record unfortunately doesn't reflect whether that was asked and what the response was, but the point is, as Lieutenant Glover testified, because it's a conversation by cell phone, you cannot be sure of the girlfriend's location.
But it belies the notion that there was any active concern at that time that she was in there with him. Thought she was in there with him. Where are you? Are you safe? We don't have any information that any of that was pursued.
Right, but regardless of whatever response she might have given, police would not be able to ascertain her physical location through a conversation by cell phone. She may be under duress, or there may be some other reason
but
she is
saying,
not.
Hey, I live two blocks away. Do you want to talk to me? Send someone over. That would have resolved that, right?
Right, but it's plaintiff's burden. We have no indication in the record that that would have resolved it. In addition, you're not sure whether there are other persons in the apartment,
but
other people.
There were actually two searches here, right? The ERT goes in there. They find no person, no contraband, nothing happens at that point. And yet there is a second, more intrusive search. So once they know there's nobody in there that's in any immediate danger, why then would they get a warrant?
Well, there is the additional concern about hazardous materials, and that is an exigency that would excuse the warrant requirement. There's no contention even that a warrant would be available
but what's
to
the,
search
well,
for hazardous materials.
What's the concern? You know, what's the basis of the concern that there are hazardous materials here?
Well, we do have to look at the totality of the facts and circumstances. I think, Judge Pillard, you laid out the facts that the officers had and that they are undisputed facts. The only contest I heard this morning was with respect to the gas, but it is undisputed that police at least received reports of a gas leak, that the gas company did come out and shut off the gas line.
Okay, by the time they're searching, though, the gas leak is no longer a problem. If that was a problem, it's been turned off. So we're not worried about that. So what's the basis of the exigency that there is hazardous material here?
Well, I disagree that we're no longer concerned about gas. The gas could still be remaining in the apartment. It could be a symptom or an indicator that there is some hazardous condition that remains. I would point this court to the Tyler case, Michigan versus Tyler. That involved a fire, and the Supreme Court explained just because the fire's out doesn't mean it's not reasonable. In fact, it is reasonable to investigate further to determine the cause in order to ascertain whether there is some continuing hazardous condition existing. And we have all the facts and circumstances that were discussed earlier.
First
of all, you know, the gas company has turned off the gas. If there were continuing circumstances of that kind, you would think it would be the gas company's employees and not the police who would be trying to verify that. But leaving that aside, what else is there?
Well, there are the various facts that we had a several-hour barricade situation in which Mr. Corrigan had been threatening suicide with a gun, that he had weapons, multiple weapons, that he had a bag full of unknown military items, which he had instructed his girlfriend specifically not to touch, that he was an expert in improvised explosive devices, that he had trained others.
So you're going to say that if you are former military, you've got a green duffel bag, and it may have military items in it, this justifies people just coming in and doing a completely intrusive search of your home when you've not given consent?
No, Your Honor, I'm not saying that at all. Again, all the facts and circumstances.
All right, the only other facts you have is he called, mistakenly, the suicide hotline. So it's the rule that anyone who calls a suicide hotline who has military training and refuses to allow the police to enter his or her apartment is subject to a warrantless search?
No, Your Honor, because there's a lot more facts than that.
What more is there here?
That he lied to police about his whereabouts.
How many units are in this building?
Just two. There's the basement apartment and the individuals living above.
All right. So everybody is out of the apartment, and as Judge Brown's question points out, the first search determined that there was no one inside.
That's correct. But we still have the concern about hazardous materials.
And is the concern? Tell us more what they're worried about. So there was natural gas, Pepco's, or Washington Gas has turned it off. Tell us, it's not the guns. What is the hazardous material concern?
Well, the guns and the ammunition can obviously contribute to a hazardous condition, just as the gas can. I would also point out, too, we do argue, even though the officers didn't search for firearms, that the existence of the firearms, the need to secure them to prevent them from being used and concealed, was an exigent circumstance as well.
But why? He's out of the house.
The question is why you don't have a warrant.
Yeah.
So, yes, you may want to secure those firearms and the ammunition, but that isn't something that you couldn't get a warrant to deal with.
Well,
the question here is, what was exigent? What was the emergency?
It's exactly the Hendricks case, for example, which we relied upon, and other cases from this court where the existence of the firearm, the concern that it could be used later or concealed later, created the exigency.
By whom? You have taken away Mr. Corrigan.
He's not under arrest. He has voluntarily admitted himself. He could decide
no, in
to...
In fairness, he voluntarily committed himself, but as soon
admitted,
as he...
Sorry.
Admitted.
Yeah.
As soon as he released himself, he was taken to the 5th District. and charged. So the implication is if he hadn't admitted himself, he would have been charged that night.
No, Your Honor, it was 3 days later. He was arrested pursuant to an arrest warrant.
He was in the hospital 3 days.
That's right. But the concern was he could, as soon as he checked himself into the hospital, could have come back out. He could have had somebody else arrange to retrieve the gun.
It would be less intrusive to post someone outside of the house.
I don't think that's required under the case law. For example, the same argument could be made in Hendricks and the other cases we cited.
The facts in those cases show someone's still in the apartment. Those are factually, they don't get you all the way there. So what we're facing is a situation of what is the exigency in these facts. One of the difficulties that I think you have is that it's pretty clear from the officer's testimony that they believed when they came in one of these helping calls, responding, not investigating crime, but somebody in distress and, trying to basically save him without officers getting killed, that they didn't need probable cause. They pretty clearly said that. So they're just like, oh, we're here on that kind of search, and therefore, exigent circumstances, and therefore we're not even thinking about probable cause, and we kept someone there, and we stayed in, and we went in, and with camel's nose under the tent, allowing them, they seem to think.
Well, first of all, the test for exigent circumstances is not probable cause, as the Supreme Court indicated in Fisher, for example. It's an objectively reasonable basis to believe that someone might be needing assistance or that there might be hazardous materials inside. We also have the community caretaking doctrine, which we haven't talked about, and that does cover more broadly circumstances that might not fall within the narrow scope of exigent circumstances.
You're not saying that you can invade a home and do the kind of search that the officers did here without, I'm for shorthand referring to it as probable cause, but an objectively reasonable belief based on the facts and circumstances known to the officers that there is an exigency, that there is...
Correct. There has to be some basis, and it's an objectively reasonable basis.
More than a reasonable suspicion type basis, but really...
Well, I don't know. I don't think it's quite as high a standard as probable cause. I think it is difficult to articulate without a specific factual context, and that's why also qualified immunity comes into play here as well, because we don't have, even assuming that the search was unconstitutional, a reasonable officer could have believed, in light of clearly established law or lack of clearly established law, indicating that this search was unconstitutional in these particular circumstances. So we have the qualified immunity argument as well, which...
I thought that the case law said, and the Supreme Court said, exigent circumstances, you have to have probable cause to believe.
No,
I
think if the exigent circumstance is based on criminal activity, for example, the concern that criminal evidence is going to be destroyed or you have a hot pursuit of a criminal suspect, in the criminal context, yes, probable cause. Where the exigent circumstance and the need to help people who might need assistance and to check for hazardous materials, those aren't criminal-based investigations, and so we're not talking about probable cause.
Probable cause is a threshold to protect the privacy of the home, and even though the content of the showing, as you correctly, I think, point out, would be focused not on crime but on some other counterbalancing governmental interest, why would it be a lower level of concern in the non-criminal law enforcement context that would suffice to override the privacy?
Right. Well, the courts have talked about this, that where the officers are not engaged in the, quote, competitive enterprise of ferreting out crime, that there's less of a concern, there's less of a need for the warrant requirement. In fact, the warrant requirement may not even apply at all because it applies in the context of criminal investigations, but where there's no criminal investigation, where the officers are acting out of community caretaking interests, there's not even a warrant requirement, there's not a warrant requirement, and there may not even be a warrant to obtain in the first place.
Of course, this court has not decided whether that doctrine applies in this context.
Sure, but that ambiguity creates qualified immunity for the officers, that there is not that clearly established law. We pointed to cases from other circuits.
Suppose there's clearly established law, and if you want to go into somebody's house and you don't have probable cause to arrest that person, you've got to get a warrant.
Well, that's true in the criminal context, which is not basically what we have here.
You're arguing where there are all these 20 police officers in a barricade. It's not a criminal situation. And you've evacuated the building. So anybody who has firearms in the house, you can go in to get those firearms because the occupant may come back, or get somebody else to go into his apartment get the guns?
I mean, that's just one of the bases we're relying upon, that's Hendricks. We're not asking for anything more than Hendricks decided and other cases of this court.
This is not Hendricks. I mean, you've got to...
But in any event, even if the law were unclear, even if there are concerns about the constitutionality of the search, the existence of qualified immunity would cover the officers here because there is no clearly established law. The plaintiffs point to no case with any analogous factual circumstances. We pointed to the Fisher case from the Supreme Court, the In Re Seal case from this court.
The plaintiff starts with the basic proposition that if you want to come into my home and you're a law enforcement official, you need to get a search warrant. That's where we start. And so if you don't have a warrant, you've got to establish that one of these limited exceptions applies.
Well,
when I first read this case, I thought, well, the police acted very responsibly. They got the gas company to turn off the gas. They took the other people out of the building. They tried to contact the plaintiff. When they finally did, he came out of the building and admitted himself to this hospital.
Well, as the Supreme Court said in Kentucky versus King, the ultimate touchstone is reasonableness, and that reasonableness applies even to exceptions to the warrant requirement. So reasonable exceptions would apply even when a warrant is required.
But exigency can't be mere suspicion, though.
All I can do is point to the Supreme Court and its objectively reasonable basis to believe. I would discuss the facts in Fisher where the individual was throwing objects. There was no indication that anybody was inside, but the Supreme Court said it was still reasonable to believe that there might be a person who was at the receiving end of what was being thrown, even though there was no evidence whatsoever that there was, in fact, anybody else inside the home.
What about the first search?
I'm sorry?
What about the first search? Establishing no one was in the apartment.
That's true, but then there's the concern about hazardous materials.
So that's all we're dealing with here. That's the only justification for going in back in to the apartment.
Well,
everything else is taken care of because the police have evacuated the building, turned off the gas.
Well, the concern about somebody else being inside is taken care of, but the larger public safety concerns are not taken care of.
What is the larger public safety concern?
That there is some hazardous condition inside that apartment so that there could be an explosion that could affect... I mean, these are row houses, so there are houses immediately joining on both sides.
So normally would the gas company come to check for leaks?
There's...
No, I mean, a police officer isn't a trained...
Right, but you would, I respectfully, I can't even begin to conceive that in this particular situation, under these sets of facts, that you would send the gas company in rather than police officers, where you have the indications of military items in the house, weaponry. There was thousands of rounds of ammunition inside.
So what did they think?
They didn't know that.
A weapon with a gun and ammunition with nobody to shoot it. Just tell me more about what the concern is.
Well, in terms of the hazardous condition, just looking at that, right, that the weapons could be, or the ammunition could be booby-trapped in some way, that they did actually check for that. Some sort of explosive condition.
There's some bomb that's been set. It's not that there's just guns and ammunition. It's not that there's just Washington gas. Don't they have to think that there's something actually been, say a fused object, there's something that's been set to go off. Otherwise...
Well, an objectively reasonable basis to believe that
yes.
might be true.
Yes.
Either that it's been set, I mean, something intentional, or it could be something unintentional. Something had become unstable. One of the military items had become unstable. That perhaps in the course of contemplating suicide that he rigged something up. That whether intentional or unintentional, The officers are operating in uncertainty, and they're always going to operate uncertainty in these particular cases. And I think in light of the Supreme Court cases, Fisher and others that have addressed exigent circumstances.
Fisher is quite different on its facts. There's blood everywhere. There's smashed windows. There's a smashed up pickup truck outside. There's apparently sort of an ongoing melee of violence. They see the guy through the window, you know, shouting, pummeling.
Yeah, but there's no indication that anybody else is there. The blood, he has a cut on his hand, which officers can see. In fact, they can see into the home well enough to see him and what he's doing. The blood is explainable by the cut on the hand.
Even to protect him, it seems like there's some interesting going in. Someone who's been in an accident and is bleeding?
We have in this case many more facts supporting a search than in Fisher. We have somebody who is clearly suicidal, called a suicide hotline and threatened to kill himself with a gun. We have the existence of the firearms. We have military items. Again, none of these facts existed in the Fisher case. Suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder,
domestic issues with the girlfriend. No indication that this man has any explosives. No indication that he's a bomb builder.
Well, I think there is, so that he is an expert.
No, he knows how to dismantle them.
Well, that's still expertise in the subject matter.
I understand, but I mean, what do the police need to come into my house?
Well, I want to emphasize that, you know, each fact, you could look at each fact in isolation and say it's relatively mundane. It doesn't arise to the level of an objectively reasonable belief.
No, what I was trying to get you to focus on is the police have taken these precautionary steps. The gas is off. They've evacuated the building. The plaintiff is in custody outside of his apartment.
Right.
Then I was stopping there, but then Judge Brown's question points out there was a first search. There is nobody inside.
That's correct, but that doesn't eliminate the hazardous condition that might exist
because
inside the house.
Because he's been in the military, or he has weapons.
That's part of the factual context. It's not the entirety of it. And the Supreme Court said that even lawful conduct can be a basis for concern when you look at the totality of the circumstances. You also have to judge the officers not, you know, with hindsight, but from their perspective on the scene in a tense and uncertain situation where they have to react and make quick decisions. And that's...
Now, this is, what, almost 6 hours we're talking about now?
Right.
They've got the barricade. Everybody's out of the building. The gas is off. And they're just waiting for this man to respond to phone calls, and he finally does. But, I mean, 4 hours has passed, 5 hours has passed.
Yeah, well, it's a constantly evolving situation. Information is coming in. They're trying to contact Mr. Corrigan. He's not responding. Things develop and occur. I would also point this court to the Ninth Circuit decision, another Fisher case, in which the court said that in this type of standoff barricade situation that it's unreasonable to require officers to go get a warrant at the same time they're trying to deal with a situation like this. Their efforts should be focused on peaceably resolving the situation, and to require them to go get a warrant is just bad policy. In fact, it would suggest that police officers should act hastily in order to avoid creating the time in which a warrant could arguably be obtained. It also encourages individuals to continue the standoff so they have an argument that, well, a warrant should have been obtained.
In the Seventh Circuit, it only takes 30 minutes to get a warrant, according to its case. But
right.
Here, I gather, one of the supervisory personnel said it would take 3 to 4 hours.
4 to 5 hours, and that was undisputed, and it was late at night.
I don't understand that at all, since judges are on emergency call in the Superior Court with magistrates. U.S. attorneys are on emergency call.
Lieutenant Glover testified that, and this is based on his experience,
that
it takes...
No, I know. We have that there in the record. I understand.
And it's late at night. The weather is very poor. It's snowing. It's icy. There's no provision in the Superior Court rules for a telephonic warrant. It's a perfectly...
So the Fourth Amendment's just set aside.
No, Your Honor, I think we've cited...
That can't be the explanation, all right, that they're icy conditions, so we just don't worry about the Fourth Amendment.
No, Your Honor, I was just responding to the question about how long it would take to obtain a warrant, and that's part of the calculus, part of the factor that it would take 4 or 5 hours to get a warrant. And in that amount of time, a lot of things could go badly. There could be somebody inside needing assistance. Those 4 to 5 hours are going to be critical.
We're already past that. There's nobody inside.
We're just talking about the additional incremental intrusion.
What the police know is he has guns and he's a military man who knows how to disable bombs. And he's suicidal, but he's outside now.
Yeah.
In police custody.
Well, we have all the facts. I'm not limiting myself to anyone. And I would point out qualified immunity as well.
But what about Judge Pillard's inquiry to you about where did the police indicate they were concerned that there might have been some fuse-making emergency?
I'm sorry, did you say fuse-making?
He had set a bomb.
Again, it's not limited to him intentionally setting a bomb, but the existence of the military items that, you know, the girlfriend had been told do not touch, his military expertise, his suicidal state, post-traumatic stress disorder, depression. He was taking medications. This is in a highly unstable, volatile situation. And you have to look at all those facts and circumstances to consider whether a reasonable officer could believe. Even if this court is not inclined to find the search was constitutional, under qualified immunity and clearly established law, there's no clearly established law that would say under these entirety of facts and circumstances we have here that it would be unreasonable for an officer to believe that there was...
But this burden is incredibly broad because you're saying, well, the community caretaking exception is broader than exigency. So let's assume that's true, but I see no limiting principle to what you're describing. Someone calls a suicide hotline doesn't even mean they're suicidal, and there are indications in this record that was not the case, that he actually accidentally got the suicide hotline. But
well, that's not the information police had.
Let's assume that the police think that he's suicidal. But the only other thing they have is once you put that aside, just about everything else you're describing could apply to very many people. Ex-military, has firearms, knows something about IEDs. So that sets you up for this very broad-ranging search.
But the evidence, the undisputed evidence, is that Mr. Corrigan was, quote, an expert in improvised explosive devices.
Well,
and we have all the facts and circumstances regarding this.
The idea that he's an expert comes from the ex-girlfriend who says he used to dismantle IEDs and he has a green duffel bag. Again, you know, there are going to be a lot of people in the population who have that experience. So that's all there is?
I don't think a lot of people are experts in improvised explosive devices and actually train others. This is also undisputed. Train others in handling these devices. That seems to me a very small segment of the population.
From that, you make the leap that he's a bomb builder because he knows how to take them apart. Then you make the leap that there's something hazardous in his apartment.
Well, not just from that one fact. There's all the facts and circumstances here.
So, Chevrolet, whose burden is it to show exigency? I mean, Dawkins, for example, says, you know, warrantless search does require probable cause, whether it's of the exigency or of criminal conduct, and it is the government's burden to show that the conditions obviating the warrant requirement are present.
I think, as Ms. Rademacher acknowledged, that it is the burden on the plaintiff in a civil case, ultimately, to prove her case, his case, and so the burden of proof is on the plaintiff. I would also point to the fact that on qualified immunity, this court in Doe versus District of Columbia found qualified immunity because exigent circumstances was not clearly established. That case had to do with removal from a child from a home. But
had,
the point
had,
there
what,
that...
Had what?
That case involved the removal of a child from a home, but the issue was...
The child was in the home?
Right. But in awarding qualified immunity, this court recognized that the scope of the law regarding exigent circumstances is not clearly established and granted qualified immunity there. We pointed to the McDonald case from the First Circuit, which also granted qualified immunity based on the community caretaking doctrine. It recognized the uncertainty of the doctrine was precisely why the officers were entitled to qualified immunity in that case. Once again, here, we've relied upon that doctrine to the extent the law is uncertain and doesn't support the constitutionality of the search under that doctrine, does warrant qualified immunity, as the First Circuit held in the McDonald case. I would also point out that Officers Pope and Leone relied upon Lieutenant Glover and his directive to search the apartment. And so that their reliance on a supervisor's directive in a situation where they were not in a position to question it, given the tense and rather dangerous and alarming
now,
circumstances.
Qualified immunity wouldn't apply to the District of Columbia. And we have, as I mentioned before, we have, is it the lieutenant's, Glover. Testimony that he believes that, you know, 99.9% of the time when they come in response to a, you know, something like this, a suicide situation, they barricade, they're going to go in. He says they don't need probable cause to go in. This is a different kind of a search. Why isn't there at least a factual issue for trial on the District of Columbia's liability here?
Well, because municipal liability does require a rather rigorous standard of culpability and causation so that it doesn't collapse into respondeat superior liability. What Lieutenant Glover testified to does not support, is not sufficient to support a theory of municipal liability. This is in the emergency response team, and they are only deployed when there are specific criteria that are met. Dangerous situations like this, hostage situation, barricade situation, high-risk warrant. And so it's not surprising that they typically go in. And when they do go in, it is either because they have a warrant, and so the search is lawful, or they have exigent circumstances, and so
if,
the search is lawful.
If they thought Mr. Corrigan was setting up an explosive device, advertently or inadvertently, wouldn't they have had to storm the building when he didn't respond? When they first got there?
Well, again, this is an evolving situation. So all the officers know initially is that the person's suicidal. They try to contact him. Efforts are unsuccessful. They gather more information. They learn about his military background. So there's and expertise with IEDs. And so the situation is developing. So I don't know at what point maybe what Your Honor posed might be true, but even then, I don't think there's any record or any evidence to sort of question police judgment or police tactics in handling the situation.
He clearly feels like it's quite gratuitous. They're going in after the fact. They've swept for people, he's out of there, and they go in, and, you know, he also has a challenge against the scope of the search, which, I mean, I know searches are, your house doesn't look good after it's been searched, but clearly he also thinks this was, given the stated interest, that this scope of this search was excessive. And so I guess the question is, if it feels to him gratuitous and destructive, you know, the government needs to say, no, we were doing promptly everything we genuinely had to do in response to the threat. And I'm thinking, well, really, there's a threat that the whole building is going to blow up? You're going to be outside waiting for him to wake up and pick up the phone? There's a little tension there. I mean,
I don't know that even if that's true, that rushing into the building with somebody who has several guns, that doesn't sound like a good idea. And certainly, again, there's nothing on the basis of this record in which you can question the officers in that particular situation.
I just wonder if there's an inconsistency that would be the right decision between the you know, objective and reasonable belief that there's a time-sensitive, explosive situation that might harm, you know, seriously harm this block, and the decision not to prompt further inquiry into that earlier.
Yeah. Oh, by actually forcing entry into the home when the individual's inside, he's armed, he's suicidal, he's got all kinds of, military items.
They don't know he's inside, because at the beginning, they've just come and they've heard from the girlfriend, but they've gotten no response from him. They know he's a veteran, they know he has IED experience, they've smelled the gas, they're getting no response from him. you know, maybe he's killed himself already and the thing is going to go off in 5 minutes. I mean,
That's the difficult situation that police officers face. They have to operate under these immense uncertainties. They have to make decisions with limited information. There are very high-risk situations. This is the sort of thing why the Supreme Court has recognized that we evaluate these situations from the perspective of an officer on the scene, and we recognize and give deference to their judgments in these sorts of situations, because it's so easy to second guess in hindsight what they did when it's simply unfair to judge them in that respect.
So is it immaterial that the police say that they found it very important that he, quote, turned around and locked the door when he came out? That's immaterial, no?
Oh, no, that is part of the calculus, part
but
of the facts here.
But that's disputed as a factual matter.
No, it's undisputed that he locked the door.
Well, it's disputed in this regard. They were drawing an inference from him taking the care to go back and lock the door, when in fact, I think there's a dispute, in the factual dispute in the record. He says he, turned the little tab in the doorknob and then actually mistakenly pulled the door closed, oops, locked it. So he didn't actually go and, do anything. He just stepped out, closed the door. And the officers are saying, oh, no, we've never seen someone take so much care to close the door. So it seems like, at least in the record, there's a factual dispute. And I think either you would say, no, that's not material, or that has to be tried. Likewise, they have this, seem to place a lot of emphasis on, I'm not intending to hurt anyone else, pregnant implication that I have already hurt someone. That's not what he said. He said no. So is that a factual dispute? Is that material? Because they seem to be acting on, oh, he implied there's someone else.
Okay.
He's hurt. So I think you have to say those are not material, or you have to say we need to resolve them.
Well, as to the latter, no, there's no factual dispute. What the police negotiator was told by Mr. Corrigan was, I'm not intending to hurt anybody else, and the negotiator relayed that to Lieutenant Glover. What Plaintiff is talking about is a different conversation with the hotline call taker, where he says he was asked if he intended to hurt somebody, and he just said no. So there's two different conversations we're talking about. It's not a factual dispute. As far as the door being locked, the testimony, as I recall, is that the officer saw him close and lock the door. But in any event, however you characterize the conduct, the officer said that he had never seen anybody in a barricade situation act like that, that was unreasonable and that was suspicious to him. And that is the sort of inference that officers are allowed to draw. I would point to the Ryburn versus Huff case, in which an individual didn't respond to inquiries by the police, and then after talking to the police, ran back inside. The lower court said, well, that's lawful. There's nothing inherently suspicious about it. It's lawful conduct. And the Supreme Court said no, that a reasonable officer could be legitimately concerned, even though you can explain away the conduct, even though you can call it innocuous, even though it's lawful, it still can be suspicious, and an officer is entitled to rely on his or her suspicion in these circumstances. And at the very least, the officers would be entitled to qualified immunity.
On that question of qualified immunity, the district court here doesn't really address the scope argument. Doesn't that have an implication for whether qualified immunity is appropriate?
No, Your Honor. There was no scope argument that was raised below. The only argument that was raised, and as I understand continues to be raised, is that they should not have searched for hazardous materials at all. The bomb technician should not have gone in at all. They don't dispute that all the bomb technicians did was search for hazardous material in places where the hazardous materials might be, that everything was pursuant to established national protocols. There's no dispute about the scope in that sense. It's only whether that incremental intrusion, I don't want to concede that there were two searches here. There was one search with two purposes. That second purpose resulted in an incremental intrusion, but in the overall scope of things, all the facts and circumstances, it was reasonable. And so that scope argument is not a basis for reversal or remand.
All right, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel for appellant?
Thank you, Your Honor. We just have two points that we would like to make. First, This case is inappropriate for summary judgment. We would just reiterate that this should not have gone to summary judgment. The district court relies on facts that are in dispute, including Mr. Corrigan saying that he wouldn't hurt anyone else on page 618, and the purported concern about gas on page 619. These facts are in dispute, and arguably this case should not have been granted summary judgment for that reason.
So the five, I think it is, reasons that the district court gives, you're saying even if those reasons are not disputed, they are inadequate to show exigent circumstances that a reasonable officer could enter?
Your Honor, we're saying that a reasonable juror could find that there were, because of these disputed facts and inferences, they could find that there was no exigent circumstances justifying that entry. And I also believe Mr. Shepherd might have misstated my position. It is the burden for the defendant to prove that there is an immunity defense. So in this situation, we are saying that we have met our burden.
And what's to prove an immunity defense or to prove exigency?
An immunity defense, Your Honor. I believe that my mistake, I believe he accidentally misstated my position. But I just wanted to reiterate that it's on the defendant to prove an immunity defense in this situation, and that has not been proven here today.
So you heard counsel for the appellees say that, in response to Judge Brown's question, that in the district court, no objection was made to the scope of the search.
Your Honor, at, I believe, docket entry 120 at page 8, we did raise arguments about the scope of the search, that it was not narrowly circumscribed. So these arguments have been made about the scope of the search.
Thank you. Anything further?
No, Your Honor. If there are no further questions from the panel,
we'll take the case under advisement.
Thank you, Your Honor.